On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Sustainable Resilient Remediation. My name is Nicole Henderson, and I am your moderator today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This training is an introduction to the ITRC guidance document, Sustainable Resilient Remediation, produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. In slide two, we're just going to run through some of our housekeeping rules for today. The training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those that are not able to join us live today. The CLUIN training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. We have the Q&A box for you to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems throughout the presentation. We will have a question and answer break about halfway through the training, as well as at the end of the training today. For those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, that will be available on the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify you participated, the certificate will be emailed to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you are participating in today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website where you can register for teams or learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. In slide four, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers for today. All of them served as members of the SRR team and volunteered to support the training that you are listening to today. On slide five, I'm going to pass this off to John Doyen with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection to orient us all for the training today. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Nicole. And welcome, everybody, to the Sustainable Resilient Remediation webinar. I'll be giving you an introduction and then handing it off to Tom O'Neill. What is sustainable resilient remediation? It's basically an optimized solution to remediate sites, hazardous waste sites. It limits the negative environmental impacts, maximizes social and economic benefits, and creates resilience against increasing climate threats. It's basically built off of the 2011 guidance documents that were produced by ITRC, the Green and Sustainable Remediation Documents. This is a picture of the practical framework, and then there's also a science and background document. But it also incorporates a strong resilience component for issues such as increasing threats from climate change, like weather events, sea level rise, and wildfires. And there's also a strong component of social and economic costs and benefits that are incorporated along with the environmental costs and benefits. So why sustainable resilient remediation? Well, I don't think you really need to be a rocket scientist to have witnessed what's been going on for the past several decades. We're seeing increased flooding, more severe flooding, hurricanes, the number of hurricanes that we're seeing in the severity of these hurricanes have increased. We're seeing tornado clusters, which we hadn't really seen before. There's droughts, and as a result of those droughts, we're seeing wildfires. The sea level has been rising, causing inundation and erosion issues. And when they're when you have the hurricanes and storms along the coastal areas, you really experience some. We're seeing and experiencing some really heavy damage. This affects and or has the potential to affect the sites that we deal with, the remediation sites. And through flooding, fires, and you see power outages and wind damage. So what do we do, or what should we be doing with regard to that? So we look at it from, I guess, two basic standpoints. Addressing the cause, which is climate change, through reducing the carbon footprint, incorporation of green infrastructure into our remedies, the use of clean and renewable energies, and overall optimization of the remediation process. In addition to that, we wanted to address the impacts of climate change through conducting a vulnerability assessment and looking at what vulnerabilities are at the site. And then as a result of those, identifying those vulnerabilities, we want to conduct mitigation through resiliency measures. So what does the report contain? Some of the more interesting pieces of this document are, there's a frequently asked questions section that not only answers your questions, but it also ties you back to the case studies. We have a case study matrix that has over several hundred case studies, and it ties you to those case studies that are related to the questions. We have a perspectives chapter that goes into the different perspectives of the different state, federal, and other interested parties. One of the things that's provided in there is a summary of the survey that we conducted in the fall of 2019, where we asked regulators from all the states how they address climate change or how they address resiliency and sustainability in their remediation processes. And if you're interested, there's also in the appendix, there's the actual results of that document or that survey. There's an interactive resource map that you can click on states, and it brings you to those resources. Tom's actually going to go into much more detail on this. In our social and economic benefits section, we talk about a lot of the tools that you can use. Elizabeth's going to go into this, but there's the US EPA EJ screen, one of them. The roadmap to do stakeholder assessments is another. There is a framework that's interactive that ties in sustainable and resilient remediation practices in with the project lifecycle. Nathan's going to go into this in much more detail. And there's a best management practice checklist that's interactive and can be utilized to tailor to your site. Michelle will go into this in much more detail. There's a, like I was saying before, there's a case study matrix with several hundred sites, but we also highlight some of the sites in the social and economic benefits chapter. Here's a couple of the sites that are highlighted. And it wraps up with a future recommendations, things like developing better metrics to track progress of sustainable resilient remediation. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Tom. Tom O'Neill.
Thank you, John. This is Tom O'Neill. I'm coming to you from Rahway, New Jersey, and let us launch into some of those resources that John just identified for you. The resources that are available in the document help you to navigate the document itself and learn about SRR. They're going to help you manage your project risk, which is a big part of SRR. They'll help you with your documenting transparency and accountability to both your internal and external stakeholders, giving you the tools to do that. And we want to stress that you can use these tools and resources at any time during the remediation process. Your best opportunity is early on in the process, but you can do it at any time, whether you're doing a remediation process optimization or a formal five-year review. These tools are available to you. And there are plenty of other resources within the document. These are just the major ones that help you navigate and learn about SRR. There's tables, charts, figures throughout. The first one I want to touch on is the state resources map. The state resources map give you the state and local flavor of SRR in your area of interest. And we break it out by our major topic areas, the climate resilience, ESR, and wildfire resilience. The type of documents that you're going to find in there are listed here, things like laws and regulations, policy and guidance, and even federal resources. This is what the main screen looks like when you encounter it in the document, and I want to point out a couple of main features. One is the key to state resources. We break it out by those major topic areas, the laws and regulations, executive orders, and so forth. Keep your eye on that orange circle. That's the laws and regulations. I'm using that as an example. There's another button here on the main screen. These are external resources. These resources we link out to at the states, non-government organizations, federal organizations. As we all know, external web links have a habit of breaking or going away. So if you encounter that when you're using our map, please let us know. Hit the updated information, or if there's something that we didn't include that you think we should have included, use that button to identify that to us. So how do you use the map? You simply click on your state of interest. My state of interest is New Jersey, where I live and where I have worked in the environmental field for 40 years. So I'll click on that state, and it'll bring up a dialog box. The dialog box looks like this, and it will break it out by our major topic areas, GSR, climate resilience, and wildfire resilience. The symbols indicate there's information for each of those topic areas, and there's that orange ball again. And we'll get to that momentarily, but you're also going to see the Federal Resources tab. This button is available on all the state dialog boxes. It's common to all of them. The information there is the same for each of those tabs. So how do you get to this information? In the dialog box, simply click on the state name, and it'll bring you to a screen that shows you the information that we were able to find on that topic. I've called out the information for the statutes and regulations, that orange ball. It will give you a little description of that resource, and then it'll give you links to those resources. Here we have a link to the web page, and it has a link to the PDF document, which is actually the 2019 law that establishes that the NJDEP shall encourage the use of green and sustainable practices during site remediation. The next major resource we have are the case studies that John mentioned. These are in Section 5. These are what I call document resources. You don't have to leave the document or leave the ITRC website to read about these. These are case studies that have been identified by the team and expanded upon by the team to feature specific SRR topic areas and to demonstrate that SRR can be successful in site remediation. Here's the life cycle and framework integration. I kind of shorthanded as the integration framework. It shows the project life cycle of site remediation across the top and then specific topic areas down the screen. Nathan Hagelin will get into a demonstration of that shortly, but I'll show you how it operates. So you simply click on one of those bars. It's an interactive screen. And I want to click on stakeholder engagement. And that's going to bring you to the stakeholder engagement within the document itself. Again, there's more information there. I tried to make this big enough to be reasonably legible, but more importantly, to show you the fact that we have resources identified and the citations referenced within the document itself. They will, again, they'll help with that transparency and ability to communicate with your internal and external stakeholders. Feel free to grab those citations and use them when you're developing your work for your particular project. It has a return to the framework button. So when you're done with, say, stakeholder engagement, want to learn about something else, such as conceptual site model, just hit that return to framework and it'll bring you back to the framework screen. Additional resources that we have available in the document include the case study matrix, which I'll get to shortly. The frequently asked questions that John touched on, and again, I want to strengthen what John said. They will help you understand what SRR is all about, and then countering it with what are the misconceptions about SRR. One of the frequent ones is that it adds to the cost of the remediation. We counter that with our frequently asked questions and strengthen that with the links to the case studies that support our answers. We also include tech sheets available in Appendix C. These are a great way to organize your thoughts on SRR for your particular state that you're working in or the project that you're working on. There's three examples in the appendix. You might want to do things like list the regulations in that state that apply to SRR. Is there funding available in that state for SRR? You put it in this briefing sheet or this tech sheet that you would keep handy for your own purposes or communicating with your internal and external stakeholders. There's the sustainable best management checklist. Michelle will get to those in a little bit. And there's 313 checklists. Don't be daunted by that. They're easy to navigate, and there are plenty of examples that will be applicable to the work that you're going to do, and Michelle will show you how to get to those. Again, here are the primary resources that are in the document itself. The state resources map gives you that the state and local connections to the external resources. The SRR framework helps you navigate the document itself and gets you to where you want to go to quickly and efficiently. And the case studies present the successes within SRR and how they were actually implemented within real life projects. So section two is where we get into the background, context, and history of SRR. We focus ourselves on the extreme weather events and wildfires, present that case study matrix, and present those frequently asked questions. We have this chart in the section two, which is basically a schematic of the site remediation history. It goes from the birth of hazardous waste management and site remediation in the 60s and the early 70s, where we were getting a handle on just how big the problem was, developing laws and regulations to control the work, and moved into the 80s and 90s, where we were working largely on-site or near-site to deal with those public health, largely emergencies and immediate threats to the environment. Then we started thinking in the late 90s and early 2000s, how can we do it better? How can we lessen the impact of the remediation itself on the environment while we're protecting human health and the environment? Now we're moving forward to where we're thinking more holistically, that the site is a part of a larger environment, a part of a community. How we got here, there were several documents that I would call informal prerequisites to our current document. They influenced what we did, and if you haven't looked at them already, we recommend that you go back into them and take a look at them. The links are here and in our document. The information is still valid and worth looking at. The first one was the EPA's, what's commonly called the Green Remediation Primer. It was one of the first documents where intentionality was brought in. By intentionality, I mean bringing in the concepts of green and sustainable work alongside with protecting human health and environment. Of course, the primary topic is protecting human health and environment, but you can do it in a way that minimizes the risk of the remediation on the environment. And this document brought that concept to the forefront. And the next one was the Sustainable Remediation Forum's white paper. This one focused on metrics. How do you actually evaluate quantitatively and through scientific tools whether you are actually being green and sustainable? They examined the Venn diagram that's on the screen, which is commonly called the triple bottom line diagram, the environmental, economic, and social issues that surround sustainability on the pivot point in that document, on that screen. And you'll learn more about that from Elizabeth Fried as we expand on those thoughts. Don touched on the Green and Sustainable Framework that our current document grows from. It was a two-pack. We had the technology overview where we explained to the ITRC community, the state regulators, the regulated community, the people who work with them, just what is green and sustainable remediation. We ran the state survey, and one of the main findings from that state survey we found was, how do we incorporate this into our site remediation projects in a practical way? So that created the tech reg document, the practical framework, which is a leveled way of evaluating site remediation projects and building in green and sustainable concepts, from best management practices at a level one to a quantitative process with best management practices at a level three. Why is it valuable? This breakout box here, the little blue one, tells it all to me. 60% of all non-federal MPL sites are in areas that are threatened, and that's threatened by environmental impacts or wildfires. What SRR brings to that is it helps with an economic return on investment. What you do to build in resilience to your projects will help you weather the storm, literally. The environmental impacts will add cost to your cleanups, and in turn will impact the social and economic setting of that particular site. I have a site out of my experience that is right along the Passaic River, and with construction complete in 1991 and operated for over 20 years without a problem. Then a storm called Superstorm Sandy came in, flooded us out. It cost us 6 months of downtime, $350,000 in direct cost, and uncounted time of staff to get the site back up and running. That cascaded into social impacts, including delaying the ready for reuse determination for the site. So I know where the costs are. I know that the tools that you're learning about today, if we had them and implemented them back then, we may have mitigated those costs or avoided those costs. The case studies, these are the case studies that are in section two. These are a 311 case studies that are found in, actually literally found in the appendix A, and it's a Microsoft spreadsheet, and we have sorted them to highlight SRR topics. So if you're interested, for example, if you're interested in only USST cases, underground storage tank cases, you would sort by the regulatory program and then find the case studies for SRR that are for underground storage tank cases. They're really easy to use tool, and you will likely find a case that matches what you're interested in there. So SRR is important and has value. It's our whole goal here today is to help everybody make our remediation successful. It can be successful by ensuring that we're not wasting resources, that's people's time, money, natural resources during the cleanup due to poor planning or poor project risk management, and bringing in those concepts of social and economic benefits, because you're not going to finish off a project unless those are addressed, and you're not going to get community buy-in without ensuring that those topic areas are addressed. So make sure you understand that they're not exactly the same concept. The quote here is right out of our document. Sustainability considers the remedy's impact on the environment, and resilience considers the environment's impact on the remedy. They're tied together. You can't have the sustainability without building in the resilience. And use these tools that we're giving you today, and I know you won't be sorry. So with that, we're going to move on to social and economic evaluations and benefits with Elizabeth Freed from the EPA.
Thanks, Tom. Okay, so I'm going to walk you or introduce you to Section 5 of the guidance, and it's focused on the sustainable and economic factors of sustainable resilient remediation. And this is going to be an overview. So fortunately, we have Nathan and Michelle following me, who are going to give you a more in-depth look at this, at how to incorporate these elements. And so Section 5 expands on the information about and resources for the social and economic dimensions of sustainability, including state-of-the-art social and economic evaluation tools. This slide represents a quick overview of the variety of information you can find in Section 5, such as the importance of including the social and economic components in a cleanup, the role of environmental justice, linking the outcomes identified by all the stakeholders to measurable metrics, using SRR tools at brownfield sites, how ecosystem services play a critical role, a variety of case studies, which Tom just gave you a nice overview over, and plenty of resources and tools. As John and Tom both mentioned, sustainable resilient remediation is more than an efficient use of resources. It's an optimized solution to cleaning up and reusing contaminated sites that, among other things, maximizes social and economic benefits. So what do we mean by social and economic benefits? Well, this is a diagram from an EPA document. The social pillar represents, in very broad terms, public policies that support social issues. These social issues relate to our well-being and include aspects such as healthcare, education, housing, and culture. In terms of sustainable, resilient cleanup, we're talking about approaches and decisions that address issues such as environmental justice, human health risks, community engagement, and sustainable communities. The economic pillar of sustainability refers to strategies that utilize socioeconomic resources to their best advantage. From the SRR perspective, economic examples include job creation related to the cleanup and reuse of the property, and the potential for site cleanup activities to trigger wider investments or development in the area. As mentioned earlier, sustainability is more than an environmental concept that asks us to be efficient with resources. It's an integrated concept that involves economic progress and enhances human equity. Because there has been the perception that economic and social concerns are external to cleanup, Section 5 attempts to dispel that perception and demonstrate that the social and economic factors are actually integral to the cleanup and to addressing the concerns and needs of the community. It provides discussion and direction on how you can effectively incorporate the social and economic factors into your project. As discussed in Section 5, project teams must engage the community early in the process and ensure that the engagement is continued throughout the cleanup process. First, project teams must identify and consider the impacts of the community of the cleanup on the community. And this can be done by gathering community data, such as the community's historical perspective of the site and the community's vision for its cleanup and reuse. It's important to understand how a site or its cleanup might affect different neighborhoods in different ways. Thoughtful, transparent, and tailored community engagement is critical. A solid SRR project can often result in lower costs, more effective and resilient remedies, and an open, trusting, and collaborative relationship with the community and stakeholders. So this slide is a visual representation of community engagement as discussed in Section 5. Before undertaking any communication or planning activities with stakeholders, the project team should identify and discuss any known or anticipated sustainable and resilient stakeholder values for the cleanup project. An easy way to do this initial analysis is through a desktop review of community demographic data. Searching local news and social media can help a project team initially assess stakeholder needs and concerns. This part of the stakeholder engagement process is considered pre-stage, and you'll see that is identified in gray on the left of this slide. So not all projects require the same level of engagement. Determination on the level of engagement and who you should engage should be made during the project planning stage and revisited as new stakeholder concerns and needs arise and as your relationship with the community evolves. Using this approach, you'll find that individual stakeholder interests in and influence on a project may change over time, necessitating a revised or more comprehensive engagement strategy. Stage one is identified as the first official stage of the engagement process and involves reaching out to stakeholders to define early SRR objectives and values. Stage two involves the project team evaluating whether the proposed remedial actions are in line with the stakeholders' needs and concerns, and if any conflicts arise, developing a plan to address them. This conflict check-in may help avoid a prolonged conflict that could lead to project delays, uncertainties in public acceptance, or unwanted negative press. Finally, stage three of the roadmap takes place during the remediation activities and involves continued communication with the stakeholders on progress, updates, and again, early identification of conflicts that may arise. Section 5 recognizes that there are strong and well-known correlations between the locations of environmental contamination and the neighborhoods of people of color and low-income residents. Minority, low-income, and indigenous communities are often the most vulnerable and overburdened by environmental and public health stressors, and therefore deserve special consideration and thus are a specific topic of discussion in this guidance. The emphasis is on fair treatment and meaningful involvement. As noted in Section 5, even the most well-intentioned project teams can perpetuate these systemic disparities if they fail to address them in project planning, execution, and operation. This guidance identifies several key factors to consider. One, robust stakeholder engagement is crucial for achieving meaningful SRR outcomes in communities with environmental justice concerns. Two, don't assume that the lead organization or other decision makers understand the concerns of the people in the surrounding community. Three, recognize that people may be suspicious that the lead organization is telling the truth, cares about them, or is willing to work with them. Four, research the full range of opinions and concerns, including general attitude, knowledge and perceptions about the cleanup activities. And five, regularly ask community leaders and the stakeholders if there are other groups or individuals who are missing from the outreach and who should be involved. So I know Tom had some information about EJ Screen, but I thought it would be helpful to give you a flavor of this resource that's mentioned in the guidance with respect to social and economic components. So as some of you may know, EJ Screen is a US EPA environmental justice screening and mapping tool that utilizes data to highlight places that may have higher environmental burdens and vulnerable populations. This tool offers a variety of data and mapping capabilities that enable you to access environmental and demographic information at high geographic resolution, which you can see on the right, across the entire country. This information is displayed in color-coded maps and standard data reports. And these maps and reports show you how your selected location compares to the rest of the nation, an EPA region, or a state. The tool combines environmental and demographic indicators to create EJ indexes, of which there are currently 11. And so you can use your site location and see, for example, the proximity of your location to a treatment and disposal facility. For SRR purposes, EJ Screen can help inform outreach and engagement practices, prioritize cleanup work, and enhance place-based activities. And EPA recently added data sets pertaining to climate change and climate vulnerability that you may find relevant to your project. And I would just like to give you a little tip and note that EJ Screen provides default numbers that you may need to adjust. So I was recently doing some EJ analysis and looking at a variety of sites and did not realize that the default location was 1 mile. And so I had to go back and do the work because I was looking at potential air deposition and I had to expand it to 25 miles. So just remember to correlate your, you know, make sure that the defaults match what you're actually trying to look at or change those defaults to what you really need. So this is just a few examples of state EJ resources you'll find in Section 5. And this is a summary of the evaluation levels. So earlier I mentioned the importance of linking the outcomes identified by the stakeholders to measurable metrics, and the tools that you'll find, the evaluation tools that you'll find will help you do that. So level one evaluation is a qualitative assessment of those social and economic best management practices that you can adopt and incorporate into your cleanup project that promote quality of life improvements and mitigate unintended impacts that could directly affect the community. Section 5 provides quite a few tools to undertake each evaluation level. For example, in level one, you can use the tools identified in this section to select various BMPs that may best fit into your cleanup project, such as a simple pre-planning checklist for assessing your project's sustainability that will give you information about the benefits or impacts to quality of life, ways to minimize the environmental footprint, resource allocation, and climate and risk. Level two evaluation combines the selection and implementation of sustainable BMPs with some degree of qualitative or semi-quantitative evaluation. In level two, stakeholders present their preference on criteria used to select a proposed project, remediation alternative, or preferred land use scenario. And finally, level three evaluation combines the selection and implementation of sustainable BMPs with a rigorous quantitative evaluation. This level of evaluation assesses how site cleanup and restoration activities may result in beneficial or unintended social, economic, and environmental impacts. So one of the most important steps in SRR is documenting the outcomes of the project and measuring progress toward your goals. This includes clearly identifying desirable outcomes or benefits from the outset and linking them to relevant metrics or progress indicators where possible. These metrics can be chosen to fit the context of a specific project. So reviewing and choosing metrics at the beginning of the project can also help guide the identification of project goals and selection of more diverse benefit categories. Again, stakeholders should be consulted when selecting metrics to build consensus and reduce the chance for controversy over the proposed sustainable resilient outcomes. Examples of social and economic indicators include the health and safety of site workers and the surrounding community through alleviating, preventing, or mitigating contamination risks. Stakeholder engagement, where the project team records and publishes the transparency of decisions to local communities and the community's degree of engagement to identify beneficial and undesirable impacts. The development of future land use and design, and alleviating undesirable community impacts such as noise, traffic congestion, business disruptions, and compromising local heritage and cultural concerns. As many of you already know, brownfield sites are former or current commercial or industrial facilities that are currently vacant or underutilized and on which there has been or there is suspected to have been a release of a contaminant. Most of these sites are in urban settings that are in lower socioeconomic communities. These communities are also commonly located in vulnerable areas to impacts from climate change. From an environmental justice perspective, the remediation of these sites is a priority for many states. An incorporation of sustainability and resiliency into brownfields remediation benefits both the site redevelopment and the surrounding community. Social and economic factors can be represented as indicators of either beneficial or unintended impacts of cleanup and restoration activities. These indicators are helpful when articulating what socioeconomic impacts mean in the context of the project and in measurable ways to define and evaluate a project's broader sustainable and resilient risk management goals. So for example, a US EPA five-year study of brownfield sites found that residential property values increased from 5.1% to 12.8% after a nearby brownfield was either assessed or cleaned up. The study also determined that brownfield cleanups can increase overall property values within a one-mile radius by $500,000 to $1.5 million. An example of one of the resources identified in this guidance is the Climate Smart Brownfield Manual. It provides a comprehensive approach for communities on climate mitigation, adaptation, and resiliency for redeveloping these brownfield properties. As an aside, if you or your client plan to apply for US EPA brownfield grant, incorporating sustainable and resilient best management practices into an application is considered more favorably over an application that lacks this information. So ecosystem services are the specific benefits provided by an ecosystem that contribute to human health and well-being or have the potential to do so in the future. Ecosystem services that benefit humans, such as pollination or flood control, typically are not fully accounted for in economic markets, policy decisions, or individual projects. There are lots of different types of ecosystem services, and quite often the benefits from nature that people and communities receive from a cleanup are ecosystem services, even if that explicit term is not used. The identification and measurement of ecosystem services can be part of calculating the total environmental footprint of contaminated site remediation. First, site-specific ecosystem services may be identified by working with the site team and through your stakeholder engagement process. The selected ecosystem services may be quantified using existing information or through the identification of data that you will need to collect. Once relevant ecosystem services are quantified, and the key term here is relevant, your next step is to examine them in the context of BMPs. Appropriate BMP implementation can result in ecosystem protection and revitalization, which minimizes the environmental footprint of cleanup operations and can help inform discussions with the community on the cleanup and determine future land use options at the site. Identification of beneficiaries, that is, who benefits from the cleanup, is essential to the identification of ecosystem services. Community groups, tribes, municipalities, and other stakeholders are examples of beneficiaries of a cleanup site's environmental benefits and ecosystem services. Stakeholder knowledge and values help inform evaluations of environmental and ecosystem services benefits resulting from cleanup. Ecosystem management and conservation activities are common methods to protect ecosystems and maintain the services they provide, avoiding the need for finding costly alternative providers of those environmental services. Two main ways to assign value to ecosystem services are, one, avoided costs, which refers to the cost of developing engineering alternatives that are not incurred because actions are taken to protect or preserve ecosystem services, and replacement costs, which refer to the costs of engineered systems to replace ecosystem services, for example, an engineered water system to replace the natural functions. So here's the fun part. This is a before and after photo of Phoenix Park in Camden, New Jersey, which was officially opened in 2015. The park was once home to a factory on the Delaware River that made chalk and other products for about 100 years. The Municipal Utility Authority needed to figure out a way to deal with both stormwater and wastewater as separate streams. So the authority worked in conjunction with New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection and local community groups to turn this riverside plot into much-needed open space that also improved the city's water treatment system. The collaboration helped rebuild trust between the community and government agencies, which this is something that cannot be taken for granted when working with historically disadvantaged communities. Phoenix Park represents what happens when social and economic factors of sustainable, resilient remediation are integrated into the cleanup. They support redevelopment, provide important local services, and build bridges with disaffected communities. Phoenix Park represents the goals of Chapter 5, recognizing the importance of the social and economic aspects of sustainability, including a multi-level partnership, extensive community outreach, addressing environmental justice issues, and ecosystem services. Incorporating the social and economic factors into site reuse planning and implementation turned this brownfield redevelopment into a shared resource that enjoys broad community support. So this slide represents the cleanup engagement approach used by Washington State Department of Ecology. If you recall the earlier slide where I described the community engagement process, you can see the overlap of the ITRC conceptual stakeholder assessment roadmap and the roadmap used by Ecology. The orange bubbles represent public participation. As you can see, public participation is critical at each stage of cleanup and reuse. Outreach and engagement are vital to a successful SRR outcome. The Bellingham Bay Initiative brought together 14 government and industry organizations working along with residents and businesses with an interest in improving the health of the Bay. Bellingham Bay is an example of what can be accomplished when multiple agencies and organizations work with stakeholders to plan cleanups that meet the needs of the local communities using principles of integrated project planning and public participation in decision making. So as background, Bellingham Bay has an industrial history as a key port for lumber processing, creation of paper goods, and other maritime trades. And this is an example, Georgia Pacific West, a paper factory, paper So as with many industries, advances in technology and a changing local economy led to some of these businesses closing their doors or leaving town for other locations. And when these businesses left, they did not take their hazardous waste with them. The Bellingham Bay Demonstration Project resulted in the development of a comprehensive strategic environmental planning document that incorporated the social and economic factors of SRR. It serves as a national model for comprehensive environmental management. It's helping to revitalize the community's waterfront and identified 19 high-priority habitat restoration projects, as well as controlling pollution sources. Today, on the Bellingham waterfront, there are new infrastructure improvements, community amenities, including a park and kayak launch, social support, including a public meeting space and job training center, restoration of critical habitat, and places for local businesses. By taking the time to identify all these co-uses and learn what the community needed, this project has turned into a win for everybody. This vibrant waterfront brings together people, includes plans to provide affordable housing, provides rental income to the port and tax income to the city, and improves the health of residents and that of the natural environment. In conclusion, Section 5 lays out the framework to collect data, engage the community, think about the future and resilience, remember ecosystem services, and make the world a better place. Now I'm going to turn it back to our facilitator, Nicole, for questions and then a short break. Thanks, everyone.
All right, thank you, Elizabeth. We have reached our first question and answer break. I am going to remind everybody that we have the Q&A pod. It's in the lower right-hand corner. We encourage you to put any of your questions in at any time throughout the presentation, and we'll pause to answer them throughout the break. All right, let's see here. So we do have a couple questions coming in. And I will put this question out here for the speakers, and you guys can let me know who might want to weigh in. I actually think a couple of you might have some comments for it. So is resource recovery an important factor in the general decisions for the use of remediation options? I still have my trainers there. All right, well, let's just do a quick audio. Oh, great.
Okay, hi, Nicole. This is John Doyon. We don't really go into resource recovery too much in the document itself, but it's certainly something that is important in you're considering sustainable practices. Tom might be able to talk to whether or not it's discussed more in the Green and Sustainable Remediation document. But that's
Yes, Tom. Yeah, no, it is not, and it's a good point that we should look at that as a area of interest.
Great. Appreciate that input. The next question is kind of how do we begin to incorporate SRR into the remediation practices? What suggestions would assist with prioritizing SRR into day-to-day remediation practices?
Well, this is Elizabeth. Are we not going to, I think that Nathan and Michelle will answer that in the next few sessions, don't you think?
I think that's fundamental to what's coming up in the next couple of sections, correct?
Okay, wonderful. So still more to learn here. So let's see if the next two sections will answer the question, and if not, please feel free to provide information. So that we can clarify the question at the last Q&A break. How about one more about the resources within the document? So does the SRR guidance document include a spreadsheet-based tool for generating project-specific data and reporting metrics?
Hi, this is Michelle, and yes, it does, and I will be going over that in depth in the part of the training that I give.
Well, I'm going to think, I think that we are getting into some of the good information that we're about to share. So since some of these questions are already anticipating what we're going to talk about, I am going to cut this short, and we'll do a longer Q&A break at the end. But
yeah, Nicole, it's Elizabeth. I think that's a great idea because we don't want to steal the thunder that's coming up because it really is good information coming up.
Yep, great. Okay, so we encourage you to continue to populate your questions and answers in the Q&A pod throughout the presentation. We'll review these and then we'll hopefully address some of the ones that we think need to still be answered after we get through our next presenter. So I'm going to move it to slide 68 and turn this over to Nathan Hagelin with Wood PLC to discuss integrating SRR.
Thank you very much. Before I get started, I just want to make a couple of introductory points. First of all, the deliberate sort of renaming of the document to Sustainable and Resilient Remediation, which I think, you know, represents a transformation in how we think about what we used to call green and sustainable remediation. And that's the influences there are climate change and the need to build resiliency into these remediations that sometimes stay in place for a long, long time, but also influences on in the arena of social values, equity and justice. And what I'm going to be talking about is how we incorporate SRR into the full project lifestyle. So it's something you think about from day one. And I believe that really represents a quantum leap from what we were doing in 2008 and up until now, which was focusing on a process that would arrive at a remedial solution, and then we would green that up, if you would. So no real, not as much influence in the whole process, but select the remedy and then green it up. No, now we are integrating SRR from the very get-go. And if I could ask Nicole to put up the slide notes, that would be helpful for me in my presentation. Okay, so I'm going to walk you through the process of integrating SRR throughout the project lifecycle. So you're going to learn how to integrate social considerations through stakeholder engagement, how to consider natural resource use or conservation throughout the project lifecycle, how to seek ways to minimize the project's carbon footprint, and how to address vulnerability to changing climate, weather, and fire hazards. So we've seen this diagram before, and as a project progresses through the various phases of the project lifecycle shown along the top of this SRR integration tool, the SRR incorporates components below them which are considered and integrated. The interactive SRR integration tool shown here was designed to help users visualize the relationships between the typical remediation project lifecycle and the SRR components. And you'll note during my section on some slides in the upper right-hand corner, I have clipped out pieces of this diagram to show you where we are in the SRR integration process. So, of course, if you've ever taken an ITRC training course, you understand that every successful remediation project has a fully vetted conceptual site model at its core. The diagram on this slide puts the SRR CSM at the heart of the project. Grounding all aspects of the project is the threat of climate and wildfires. Threat mitigation is integral to the process and relies on stakeholder engagement, including the incorporation of social and economic best management practices, which Michelle will talk about in detail following my section, and the consideration of green and sustainable elements in remedy selection and design. and the incorporation of sustainable best management practices in the implementation, operation, maintenance, and optimization of the remedy. An SRR CSM incorporates additional elements that consider the short and long-term effects of climate change and wildfires on the resiliency of the remedial solution, including the future variability of climate and wildfire threats, stakeholder engagement in remedy selection and site reuse, integration of climate and wildfire threats and stakeholder concerns into the remedy, and of course, the conceptual site model is updated throughout the project lifecycle to account for changed conditions and threats. For the SRR guidance document, we've updated the ITRC guidance document, Remediation Management of Complex Sites, published in 2017, with sustainability and remedy resilience. Ultimately, the SRR conceptual site model seeks to provide the information necessary to consider remedies that are protective to human health and the environment in anticipation of more frequent and severe weather events, wildfires, and other climate change hazards, while also accounting for important social and economic influences to the site and community. The SRR CSM uses forecasted changes in the frequency and severity of extreme weather events and wildfires and longer-term changes as a means to consider future direct and indirect impacts to the remedy. These impacts might result in reduced remedy effectiveness, a decline or degradation in natural resources, acceleration of geomorphic processes, and prolonged environmental stressors such as sea level rise and drought. As noted earlier, SRR-CSM also incorporates periodic updates to consider condition changes like new climate change information and forecasting. This table from Section 7 of the guidance document provides an example of climate change factors for the SRR conceptual site model. Traditional CSMs typically do not incorporate sustainability considerations or resilience to local climate change impacts. The lack of sustainability considerations can result in a remedy that creates an unnecessary depletion of natural resources and unanticipated increases in greenhouse gas emissions. In the absence of local climate change data in the conceptual site model, remedial designs often incorporate default or regional climate information. This remedial design approach may not necessarily generate the appropriate level of engineered resilience for the anticipated life cycle of the remedy. Emerging conceptual site model frameworks have begun to recognize these inadequacies in the traditional CSM approach. So let's start with stakeholder engagement. This is important throughout all project components. The social dimension of SRR include considerations of stakeholders' needs and concerns, often called stakeholder values. In this context, site-specific objectives, goals, and processes for an SRR assessment are informed by multiple stakeholder values. Transforming sustainable, resilient benefits and mitigating unintended impacts to environmental justice, see Section 5.2 of the guidance document, and other underserved communities are core components of SRR. Like the conceptual site model, stakeholder engagement evolves throughout the project lifecycle, demonstrating the importance of developing and implementing a continuous phased engagement process. In this SRR guidance, as mentioned earlier in this training, we've established three levels of evaluation based on the complexity and profile of the site. So I'm reinforcing here something that you heard earlier in this training. And this allows SRR integration to be flexible and adaptable to scope, scale, and budget. Identifying extreme weather and wildfire potential are important as they may influence the selection of the most appropriate level of evaluation. Sites that are particularly vulnerable to extreme events may require a higher level of evaluation. Level one, we evaluate exposure scenarios, determine which extreme weather events and wildfire scenarios could occur, and then adopt our sustainable best management practices, which are discussed in detail in the next section of this training and in section 7 of the guidance document. For level two, in addition to level one SBMPs, level two evaluations incorporate some degree of qualitative or semi-quantitative evaluation. For example, simple mathematical calculations and tools, weight and rack approaches, stakeholder input, and some examples of those tools that are referenced in the guidance document include the spreadsheet for environmental footprint analysis, CEFA, the SiteWise model, and the Social Sustainable Evaluation Matrix, or SSAM. And then level three incorporates a full vulnerability assessment with rigorous quantitative evaluation, such as climate models that are downscaled to the site scale and life cycle assessments for environmental sustainability. So next we'll take a look at the characterization stage. During the site characterization stage, pardon me just a moment, there are three major categories of SRR integration to be considered during the site characterization stage that are different or perhaps supplemental to traditional approaches. In addition to defining nature and extent of contamination, we also collect data on extreme weather, wildfires, and other site-specific risks, such as sea level change. And we collect data for resilient remedy design, such as wind and temperature extremes, erosion, et cetera. And we incorporate also we incorporate site vulnerability and climate and fire-related risk assessments. Getting SRR integrated into your data early will arm you with the information required for informed stakeholder engagement and set you up for successful and sustainable site reuse outcomes. What is required for an accurate and meaningful vulnerability assessment? What is that all about? Well, we build regional and local climate data into the conceptual site model. Site-specific data may be required to be collected. And collect data to evaluate vulnerability to climate change and extreme weather during the remedial action and long-term site management. We assess the vulnerability and identify data gaps to achieve robust vulnerability assessment, and then we reevaluate vulnerabilities and data gaps as the remedy becomes more clear. As you transition from site characterization to the remedy planning phase, you need to be thinking not just about the most technically and cost-effective approaches, but also about the most sustainable and resilient approaches to meet your remedial action objectives. So we always identify, screen, select, and design the best remedy to meet the remedial action objectives in the protection of human health and the environment. But we also select remedies with low impact that attain those RAOs, and align with stakeholder, community, and economic development needs. And on an ongoing basis, the remedies should be effective and resilient, both short-term and long-term. This is the best opportunity at this stage to create lasting SRR influence on the project overall. There are specific actions you can take during the remedy planning stage that will influence remedy selection and project outcomes. Establish resilience metrics. How will you measure resilience and what will be your design constraints? For example, how much sea level rise, how intense and infrequent the wildfires, how intense the storms. Conduct a vulnerability assessment of the technologies against these metrics. Can the vulnerabilities be mitigated through adaption or sustainable best management practices? Breach Alternative Identify Adaption Strategy, SBMPs. Calculate the level of effort and cost of adaption. There's always a cost benefit for every adaption. And then document and include that evaluation in your remedial action plan. Include a section on sustainability in your remediation and write down your vulnerability assessment so you can refer to it going forward, what you documented to be those constraints. And then in the remedy design stage, we look at how to integrate SRR, which is primarily about preventing failure. But you've selected your remedy, and now you want to make sure you build it to be resilient following a deliberate stepwise process. So first, you update your vulnerability assessment and determine whether the risk is acceptable to the engineer, the regulator, to the stakeholders in the community. And then you select the most sustainable and resilient approach to manage risk in consideration of the cost-benefit of that approach. And then you incorporate the sustainable best management practices in your design, and then document the remaining risk that was accepted. You may need to refer to the agreements made with stakeholders in the event of a remedy failure that was within the accepted risk tolerance. So there's always a balance between risk and reward for all of our projects. We cannot plan or design for every inevitability or eventuality, and SRR is not a perfect science, but rather an informed process to assure a better outcome no matter the scale or complexity. This is extremely important in the context of SRR. Although climate models and our overall understanding of climate change is improving with time, there remains uncertainty, and uncertainty is magnified when it's projected at the scale of an individual remediation site. While it's safe to assume sea level rise will continue for the foreseeable future, we can't accurately predict the rate and magnitude of sea level rise at an individual point in space. And therefore, the principal tenets of SRR suggest that we plan conservatively so that our remedies will endure throughout the project lifecycle. However, when conservative approaches greatly increase costs, it may not be practical or even possible to implement them. Therefore, we introduce and accept risk in remedy planning, and we negotiate that risk with stakeholders to achieve reasonable expectations for project outcomes. We categorize that risk management into remediation risk, is the remedy vulnerable? Resilience risk, is the remedy resilient to the identified vulnerabilities? And sustainability risk, are there unintended impacts that require mitigation? You can, for more on this, refer to ITRC's guidance document, Project Risk Management for Site Remediation, published in 2011. The OM&M stage for active remedial solutions is often the longest stage in the project lifecycle, and therefore it can have a large footprint. Given O&M can continue for decades, the vulnerability risk is high, and it increases with time due to climate change, extreme weather events, and wildfire. Therefore, resiliency is a key factor during O&M. For example, a capping system designed to reduce infiltration must be resilient to extreme weather and climate-related degradation permanently, or at least until the waste beneath it is environmentally degraded. The cost benefit of resilience during O&M is a key business factor affecting responsible parties. For example, a simple, inexpensive prefabricated treatment shed may represent low capital cost at the onset of the project, but the cost of replacement must be considered in the context of the treatment shed's resiliency to extreme weather and wildfire. It may not be the lowest life cycle cost, and it may not receive stakeholder acceptance, and there may be reputational risk associated with going that route. Optimization is, by its very nature, an SRR activity. And it often presents a unique opportunity to reduce the environmental footprint of a remedy. There are many types of optimization activities, including the reducing the redundancy and incorporating more efficient procedures in the performance monitoring program, switching to or incorporating more local labor, local laboratories and suppliers, or transitioning from an active to a passive remedy, such as monitored natural attenuation, and adapting to remediation projects by adjusting stakeholder expectations and the site reuse plan in circumstances where the remedial action objectives are determined to be unrealistic or unattainable. The reuse and redevelopment phase provides an opportunity to positively impact the community. Ideally, the reuse plan has been baked into the project from the onset, but there's still opportunities to influence sustainability of the site going forward. Continue your engagement with the stakeholders in the community. Develop a reuse plan around the real and tangible needs of the community. Address environmental justice concerns. And you make improvements to an area that has been historically oppressed by inequitable environmental degradation. Do environmental land use restrictions impinge on reuse value to the community? For example, does a no-build restriction due to vapor intrusion unfairly impinge on reuse? And can it be released through appropriate engineering controls? Future climate change needs to be addressed to ensure long-term protectiveness. Is the reuse plan resilient to extreme weather events and wildfire? Might want to perform or revisit the vulnerability assessment. Can the remedy accommodate identified climate change risk factors considering the long-term reuse plan, and have those risk factors change since the remedy was planned? And then the cost-benefit analysis. Is it an efficient use of resources to design and construct for resilience, as opposed to reserving for the potential uncertain cost of repairs? Let's turn now to a case study for illustrative purposes. During this section of the training, we're going to refer to the Pharmacia Upjohn case study, which is presented in the SRR guidance. The Pharmacia site is located in North Haven, Connecticut, along the Quinnipiac River. This site was formerly mined for clay and brick production and then used for chemical and electronics manufacturing. This case study does predate this new SRR guidance document, but it's an excellent example of incorporating SBMPs and a sustainable community-driven outcome. During the site characterization stage, Pharmacia implemented and documented many practical SRR components listed on this slide. What's noteworthy about these, and was hinted at earlier in the training, is these priorities serve the dual purpose of reducing carbon footprint and cost. Also noteworthy, the process from project planning throughout site reuse requires perseverance and dedication. It can take a long time, and it's often not at all a linear process. Sticking with the Pharmacia Upjohn case study, this time as an example of how SRR best management practices were incorporated into the remedy design and execution stages of the project. Here were the highest priority SRR considerations for each remedial component of the project. The capping systems and hydraulic barrier at Pharmacia were used to control groundwater migration, prevent impacts to sensitive ecosystems, reduce infiltration, and accommodate the on-site consolidation of contaminated soil. The SRR considerations include excellent examples of the use of on-site, local, and recycled materials, the incorporation of vegetation, and the enhancement of habitat to support biodiversity. Incorporating SRR throughout the remedial project lifecycle, beginning at the project planning phase and including a robust stakeholder engagement process, has driven the Pharmacia Upjohn project forward with a vision for site reuse in mind. At Pharmacia, a sustainable outcome to remediation is being realized, one that takes into account the environmental, social, and economic impacts and aspects of sustainability built around a resilient remediation and enduring site reuse plan. By creating habitat, opening the site to the community as an ecological preserve, and retaining a portion of the property for commercial development, the end state of this project addresses the social, environmental, and economic needs of the community. So in wrapping up my section, there are three main takeaways from this integrating SRR into the project lifecycle that I'd just like to review. Accounting for variability of climate and wildfire threats throughout the project lifecycle can substantially reduce long-term site management risks. Early stakeholder engagement can greatly help inform the social and economic aspects for a sustainable remedy. And yes, back to the CSM, the SRR-CSM integration of climate and wildfire data along with stakeholder perspectives provides for sustainable and resilient decision-making throughout the project lifecycle. And now I'm going to turn it over to Michelle Mullen, who's going to run you through the sustainable best management practices.
Great. Thank you, Nathan. Before we get too deep on this topic, you may be wondering, why do we call these sustainable BMPs or SBMPs? Usually, they're just called BMPs. The BMPs that we included in the guidance are not just effective and practical methods to build or adapt a cleanup site to climate change, but they also minimize impact or damage to the environment and community. Remember, this guidance, the Resilient Cleanups Guidance, builds on its GSR predecessors. Where can you get all the gems I'm about to share with you? Well, from the main page, guidance webpage, use the navigation pane on the left and go to section 7. So far in this training, you've heard the importance of SRR, the why, and the how. But you are probably still asking, what do I actually do to make the cleanup resilient? And that's where the SBMP section comes in. In this section, we give you the SBMPs, and we pair those with key resources, background information, and additional things to consider. These things added together equal a resilient cleanup approach. Looking back at the navigation pane on the left side of the webpage, you can see the SBMPs are organized by weather or climate events that may become extreme in duration, intensity, frequency, or location. Throughout this module, I will simply refer to them as extreme events. There is also a category for SBMPs that are universally relevant, regardless of which extreme event that may impact the cleanup. The extreme events included in the guidance are wind, snow and hail, fluctuating groundwater elevation levels, flooding, bank and shoreline erosion, wildfire, sea level rise, evapotranspiration, storm surge, and permafrost thaw. You can see that this guidance is very comprehensive. Due to the depth of information on wildfires, we included two sections on wildfires, one for adapting ahead of the event and one for responding. Each section includes an overview of how the extreme events generally impact remediation. This allows you to gain a better understanding of the importance of each of the SBMPs included in the guidance. We also point out which extreme events are related to the one you are reading about. We call these secondary or cascading extreme events because they may happen at the site either for the same reason the primary event happens. For example, evapotranspiration and fluctuating groundwater levels happen under similar environmental conditions. Or they may happen as a result of the primary event, such as flash flooding occurring after a wildfire. As Nathan described, climate and wildfire threats surround all aspects of the remediation project. So we organize the SBMPs within each extreme event by remediation project phase to make it very easy for you to find the SBMPs you need. We also included vulnerability assessment and crisis management SBMPs relevant to the specific extreme event you are exploring. I'm now going to show you how flexible and practical the SBMP guidance is. I'll show you how to step through the SBMP process using Figure 7-1 in the guidance. Then I will discuss a few of the universally relevant SBMPs and use a case study from the guidance to demonstrate specifics. So how do you get started? Well, you enter the SBMP cycle based on a trigger. There are three possible triggers. Number one, you may know that the site is in a region with a general vulnerability, such as generally being under a drought. Or number two, an extreme event may have occurred, such as flooding at the cleanup site. Or number three, you've done a comprehensive vulnerability assessment. If trigger number two or three is how you entered, then you can go right to the extreme event section of the guidance to find the appropriate SBMPs. However, if trigger number one brought you here, which was just a general knowledge of climate conditions in the region, you may need help identifying applicable extreme events. For example, you know your region is generally experiencing decreasing precipitation. You can use Table 7-1 to navigate to the relevant extreme events by simply following the row for precipitation decrease, and wherever an X is in the column, navigate to that extreme event. The table is hyperlinked to the sections to make navigation really easy. Once you know the primary vulnerabilities, read the overview section for each extreme event the site is vulnerable to in order to identify associated secondary or cascading extreme events to also review. After identifying all applicable primary and secondary extreme events, you can either read the SBMPs in the text of the guidance, or you can use the fully customizable tool we provide you as Appendix D. When we developed this guidance, one of the most important priorities for us was to make sure it was thorough and comprehensive, something you could really use to get beyond the concept and into implementation. We researched every source we could find to consolidate 313 SBMPs into this one-stop-shop guidance. Another top priority was making the guidance easy to use. This tool was included to allow you to completely customize it to the cleanup site specifications. The tool is filterable by extreme event and phase of the project. The tool is fillable for documenting which SBMPs are applicable and which were implemented. So now I will give you a taste of some of the SBMPs that are universally applicable, regardless of the extreme event the cleanup is vulnerable to. SBMPs for assessing vulnerability can include assuming the site is vulnerable to known vulnerabilities. I know this might sound obvious, but it's really easy for us to overlook the obvious sometimes. If the site is in a 500-year floodplain, assume it is vulnerable to flooding. Don't assume that a 500-year event isn't applicable to your 30-year remedy. Instead, consider that the flooding is likely to increase in frequency, intensity, and duration. Second, review the secondary or cascading events. We identify those for you in the overview section of each extreme event. And also review local vulnerability information. These are identified in each extreme event section and in the resources map, which is a major hub of vulnerability assessment tools. During planning and prioritizing, some SBMPs you can always implement are to seek and review traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK. TEK is uniquely defined by each tribe. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has generalized it as the evolving knowledge acquired by indigenous and local peoples over hundreds or thousands of years through direct contact with the environment. It is specific to a location and includes the relationship between the environment and people. It is not a static understanding of how the environment was. It continues to evolve and identify changes in the environment. It is an important part of the tribal consultation process and may be relevant even where formal consultation is not required and for sites not located on tribal reservations. We explain this more in the guidance. Putting SRR into your request for proposals and scopes of work ensures that contracts will be set up with SRR in mind. And extreme events can create financial risk. Use the case studies in Appendix A of the guidance to gain insight on predicting financial risk from extreme events. During remedy design and implementation, use green infrastructure and natural solutions such as plants native to the existing climate with tolerances for the likely future climate. Stormproof your infrastructure on site and consider partnering with the community to stormproof critical access or operational infrastructure not on site. Documenting your SBMP selection and prioritization process and whether they were implemented is key for reviewing effectiveness during your periodic review or after crisis management. Speaking of periodic review, one of the top SBMPs you can implement is to update the vulnerability assessment on a defined and periodic basis and adapt the SBMP implementation to match any changing site conditions. Also review the CSM on a defined and periodic basis to determine if adaptations to remedy design and construction need to be made. This review can be on the same timeline as the vulnerability assessment review. You can streamline both by coupling them with any other OM&M inspection, monitoring, maintenance, or reporting requirements. And after any extreme event, you will want to evaluate the performance of the SBMPs. Did they work as expected? Do you need to make any engineering tweaks? One phase of the project you may not yet be very familiar with, but which is predicted to increase as extreme events increase at cleanup sites, is crisis management. When responding to an extreme event, it is important to reevaluate your site boundaries and potential pathways for contaminant migration. And second, to reassess monitoring and sampling protocols. These are both important because the extreme event may have opened up new pathways for migration and may even have changed the chemicals of concern. You should also revise safety procedures to reflect the increased likelihood, duration, or intensity of the extreme event. Now that we've gone over the process of implementing SBMPs in general, and we reviewed some of the key SBMPs you can implement at any site during any phase of remediation, let's step through a real-life example. I pulled this case study from Appendix A of the guidance because it was a site that was already well into OM&M when resilience was considered. I know many of us believe that adaptation can only really be integrated during the planning and design phases. You've heard us say throughout the training that it can happen at any stage, and you've seen some general ideas, but you may still not really believe it. I hope this case study shows you how possible it is to implement SBMPs for resilience even at one of your sites, which may already be beyond planning and design. This case study is for the Iron Mountain Mine Superfund site, which is in its sixth five-year review. It's a 4,400-acre site with historic acid mine drainage discharges to multiple waterways, including a source of drinking water. The remedial action objective is to eliminate the mine discharges that are harmful to the environment. And there are already multiple interim remedies to control sources in place. So what brought this cleanup into the SBMP process? The trigger was that wildfires and severe storms created significant challenges for site operators. Although the remedies are operating as intended, climate change was not given the level of consideration this guidance recommends early on. The treatment was not built with resilience to wildfire or severe storms in mind. The ongoing extreme events necessitate resiliency improvements. So the next step is to identify and prioritize the SBMPs. Start by reviewing the wind, pre- and post-wildfire, and universally applicable SBMP overview sections. This will help you identify the possible secondary or cascading extreme events. Sites vulnerable to high winds may also be vulnerable to storm surge, bank and shoreline erosion, or evapotranspiration. Sites vulnerable to wildfire risk may also be vulnerable to flooding, fluctuating groundwater elevation levels, or permafrost thaw. Now, I think you can tell, not all secondary vulnerabilities will be relevant to a site. Knowledge about where the cleanup is located can narrow down the additional extreme events to review. For example, Iron Mountain Mine is not located on an ocean shoreline or in the Arctic Circle, so storm surge and permafrost thaw can be eliminated from further review. To identify only the SBMPs relevant to your extreme event of concern at your cleanup site, use Appendix D. For Iron Mountain Mine, start by filtering the extreme event column to only view SBMPs for wind, pre-wildfire, post-wildfire, flooding, fluctuating groundwater elevation levels, bank and shoreline erosion, and evapotranspiration. You also always want to review the universally applicable SBMPs. This filtering just for the extreme events and secondary extreme events of concern shortens the list from 313 SBMPs to 198. You can further shorten the list by filtering based on the phase of remediation. The Iron Mountain Mine remedy is already in implementation in OM&M. So filter the description column to view only the SBMPs for remedy design and implementation, OM&M, and general. Because extreme events have already occurred, you would also want to include crisis management SBMPs. And now you've cut the list of SBMPs by more than half. This is where the tool gets really awesome. As you read through the SBMPs, you can use the tool to fill in which ones are applicable and which ones are not applicable. You can then filter to only view the applicable SBMPs. Applicable SBMPs can then be sorted based on priority. You can move them around, break them out into new worksheets, add columns to denote numerical priority, do whatever works for you. Since it is fully customizable, it can facilitate discussions with a client, contractor, regulator, or community. You can all work on it together, or you can provide it as a deliverable. Another feature, it can be your documentation tool, where you note which SBMPs were implemented and any tweaks you had to make in the field. Plus, you can come back to your completed tool later to assist with SBMP evaluation during periodic site reviews. To make Iron Mountain Mine more resilient to wildfire and storms, the following SBMPs were implemented. They replaced portions of the treatment system with non-flammable stainless steel, added redundancies in the treatment system, developed a vegetation management plan, especially for plants that effectively spread fires, and they continue and have increased coordination with local emergency responders. They also have been working on updating the emergency preparedness plan and updating the asset management plan. Effectiveness of SBMPs is reviewed on a periodic and defined basis at this site. The site is subject to a 5-year review, and as part of that process, CAL FIRE conducts on-site visits to advise on fire prevention measures. If your cleanup site is not subject to 5-year reviews or any mandatory review of OM&M, long-term stewardship, or land use controls, implement a review anyway. Climate change is evolving quickly. Nathan showed us how errors increase with longer modeling timeframes. One way to overcome this uncertainty is through regular review of site conditions and updated climate projections. Regulators can consider requiring periodic review to ensure the long-term effectiveness of the remedy and protection of human health and the environment as site conditions change. Responsible parties should volunteer periodic review to reduce liabilities as site conditions change. Should the review always be a 5-year review? If you're not required to do a 5-year review, consider defining the periodic review time period as one that makes sense for the location, vulnerabilities, and community. We discuss how to do this more fully in the guidance. Reevaluating site vulnerabilities at Iron Mountain Mine occurs at the same time as evaluating SBMP effectiveness. It's all part of the 5-year review. It can also be part of the periodic review for your site. Just lump all your reviews together at once to avoid redundant work. The best way to reevaluate vulnerabilities is to perform a vulnerability assessment for the site, At Iron Mountain Mine, one way they assess vulnerability is to run climate change scenarios in their water quality model. To conclude, the SBMP portion of the guidance is flexible in three ways. First, logistically, you can read it or you can use the customizable tool. Second, it's adaptable to any cleanup site under any cleanup program at any phase, not just for Superfund and not just during planning and design, all programs and all phases. There are no required or mandatory SBMPs. Instead, you can find whatever relates to the extreme events your cleanup is vulnerable to, and you can easily find them based on the phase of remediation. The guidance is also comprehensive, with 313 SBMPs and tons of information to help you understand the importance of each one and why it was included. We scoured hundreds of sources, and they are all linked throughout the guidance and in the resources map, making this a one-stop shop for information on resilience. We also include SBMPs for responding to an extreme event, because crisis management is becoming increasingly important as climate changes. The guidance is also easy. We make it easy for you to identify secondary or cascading extreme events. We link to other parts of the guidance that go more in depth, such as the demographic analysis. We tell you which resources are likely to be the most useful for that extreme event. And we made you a tool that can custom tailor, you can custom tailor to your individual cleanup and use for documentation, evaluation, and information sharing. Now that I've told you the what of SRR implementation, you are ready. Ready to find the relevant SBMPs based on the likely extreme events for every phase of the remediation. You now know how to understand your site vulnerabilities based on known information about the site location or extreme events having occurred, or from conducting a full vulnerability assessment using the tools provided. You know how to identify the relevant SBMPs by reading Section 7 of the guidance, navigating to the extreme events that the site is vulnerable to, and using the fully customizable tool in Appendix C. You also know how to work with the project team and stakeholders to implement the SBMPs. This includes periodic review of the site vulnerabilities and evaluation of the SBMP effectiveness. You came to this portion of the training understanding the importance of an adaptive remedy, but not knowing exactly what to implement. Now you have all the tools you need to easily find the right adaptive measures for your cleanup site and ensure a resilient remedy that is protective of human health and the environment for the long term. I will now hand it back to the moderator for Q&A.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Right, so we have come to our second Q&A break, and hopefully we have managed to answer several of the questions that were already posed earlier in the first Q&A break. So we are going to dive into some of the other ones here. The first one was asked, given that sometimes given the large land holdings, have tribal entities been receptive to SRR or have a similar program?
Hi, this is Tom. We didn't find too much to get into the document itself, but in the state resources section, I know that Nez Perce tribe has a climate adaptation plan that's in there. I don't know specifically what their position is on addressing sites within their area with regard to SRR specific topics. Anybody else?
Well, this is Elizabeth Fried, I think it's an emerging field for tribes. A lot of the tribes have, policies or programs in place, and they're trying to develop this further. And so it's something that I think we're all paying attention to and trying to find ways to assist.
And we're certainly within the document encouraging the engagement of all stakeholders, and now absolutely, and we explicitly reference tribal nations as a stakeholder to reach out to.
Great, thank you. This is going to be a clarification question that was asked earlier, but we're going to reframe it here and see what the trainers have to say. So the question was rephrased, if resource recovery isn't a big factor, is near zero emissions equipment a factor taken into consideration when remediation options are being evaluated?
I just wanted to say I was going to take the hit on missing that question. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to mention that, yes, the resource recovery is covered in the guidance. And the SBMPs in particular, I mentioned that they are sustainable best management practices, which means that there are other things that can be done outside of maybe what we present in this guidance in order to make your cleanup resilient long-term. But we tried to pick only those that would make your site resilient and meet the sustainability criteria. So there are plenty of SBMPs that directly address resource reduction in use of resource or resource recovery. Also, the previous ITRC GSR-1 and GSR-2 documents identify resources and tools to deal with minimizing greenhouse gas emissions or use of dirty fuels. And also, in the case studies in Appendix A, there are 6 case studies that reference resource recovery and 25 that discuss emission reduction. So yes, we think it's an important issue to cover, and we did cover it in the guidance in a few different places.
Thanks, Michelle, and thanks, Tom, for taking the hit on that one. All right, let's do one more here, and again, a reminder that if you have any questions for the trainers today, you're welcome to use the Q&A pod, but this question here is, with respect to CERCLA 5-year reviews, has US EPA started to place more emphasis on assessing and recording potential climate change impacts to remedies? This might be too much conjecture, but see if we have an answer.
Well, this is Michelle. I would just direct you to the EPA Superfund Resilient Cleanups website for any information about Superfund CERCLA policy on resilient remediation.
Great.
From the state perspective, this is Tom. As of last year, the 5-year reviews I had seen coming out were probably drafted a year before, you know, so they're two years old, and they had not at that point, at least in Region 2, addressed that issue. But there are differences from region to region, and Michelle has got the right angle on that. Go to the EPA direct.
Fantastic. All right, we had a question about, so in addition to the EJ screening tool that was shared in the benefits section here today, what other SRR resources people view, especially for mapping vulnerable communities and for documenting community resilience?
Yeah, this is Michelle again, and I would direct you to Section 7 of this guidance. Particularly the text portion of it. So other resources are mentioned in Appendix D, the customizable Excel tool, but the text portion of the guidance describes the relevant tools for each extreme event, including mapping tools that can help you map the extreme event likelihood in any given area, which could help you identify vulnerable communities. There are also a lot of local tools provided in Section 7 in each extreme event section that describe some of the things communities are already doing and some success stories coming out of states or smaller locations or tribes. So I would just say to read over Section 7 to find more specific tools about identifying vulnerabilities and positive outcomes.
Let's do one more question here since we have a little bit of time, and I think that this is one that was touched upon and certainly would have a long story to share, but is the term GSR being phased out in favor of SRR? Will both be utilized depending on the situation?
Tom, I span both teams, so I'm a little biased towards keeping GSR around. They have similar uses, and we spend a fair amount of time with the team, discussing the terminology, and that's why we really settled on sustainable resilient remediation for going forward with most of these discussions, because it broadens the concept of the site remediation from beyond the site itself and placing it where it really belongs in an environmental setting, in a community setting. So we're pushing towards SRR, but GSR is still there and it's still in the literature and it has value. So I'm sorry to waffle on you, but I think we're pushing towards SRR, but you'll absolutely see GSR still in the literature.
Great, thank you. How about, did receive one more here that, is there any guidance available on the resilience aspects of the different remediation technologies? Michelle, do you want to start?
Sure, I'm not sure if this fully answers the question, but I'm thinking, for example, in the SBMP section, we list different ways, for example, to make your bank more resilient to shoreline erosion or to storm surge. And among those are some different approaches, such as hardscaping versus using green infrastructure or natural solutions. And we recommend using green infrastructure and natural solutions because those are both, that's a way to make the shoreline resilient. And it's also more sustainable than hardscaping, and so we kind of do discuss that in the guidance. But if you were to just go to Appendix D, the BMP you would see listed is to use natural solutions or green infrastructure. So I hope that answers the question.
Excellent. Nope, that sounds great. Always good to point back to resources developed through the guidance document. Well, at this time, I think I'm going to say a big thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC guidance document and also to the development of this training course today. We do want to hear back from you, so please remember to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. And if you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thank you so much for joining us today for this first installment of the new ITRC Sustainable Resilient Remediation Training, and we look forward to hearing from you all again on the next training. Thank you.